Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we welcome Super Agent Hughes Norton to talk about his book and so much more. So stay tuned and get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. Welcome to the show. So glad you'd be along. I've waited for this hour's guest for a lot of years. Harken back to when we started this show back in March of 1998. Actually, the 15th, to be specific. And we're the longest-running national show, and specifically about golf, and we're very proud of that. But we're also proud of our guest list. We've had greats like Ely Callaway, people that are no longer with us, and a guy this hour who went into exile, and people said maybe he's no longer with us as well, is my guest this hour. There's a new book out. There's a lot of discussion around the world about this hour's guest. We're super excited to welcome Hughes Norton to tee it up with Keith Jones. Mr. Norton, I'll call you that, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Keith. Pleasure to be here. Heard a lot about the show. Look forward to it.
Well, thank you very much. As I mentioned, we started March of 1998. On October 16th of 1998, Thomas Bonk from the Los Angeles Times wrote an article. Being fired is Norton's reward for making Woods rich. He's referring to Tiger Woods, as Norton was his agent through IMG. And as Thomas writes in his column, only a couple of months ago, Golf World ran a cover story on Hughes Norton featuring a photo of Tiger Woods, Earl Woods, and Norton with this headline: The Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. That's actually in his book, but this was from the article. This week, says Thomas Bonk, Norton was downgraded from Holy Ghost to just plain Ghost. Norton wonders what he did wrong as Woods' agent. Was $120 million in endorsement deals enough? Norton, who was fired by Woods this week, said athletes change agents all the time, but the IMG veteran finds his leave-taking a little puzzling. Norton said, quote, he earns more per endorsement than any other athlete in the world, including Michael Jordan, unquote. That major endorsement deal that Norton put together for Woods in a two-year period, Nike, Titleist, Rolex, American Express, All-Star Cafe, Wheaties, and Warner Books. I'll let Hughes Norton tell the rest of that. But, you know, it is amazing because Mark Steinberg, who worked at IMG, is still Tiger's agent. He left the agency, and that was quite an undoing of the agency because Mark McCormick died unexpectedly in 2003. So it was a loss for a lot of people, but then IMG kind of got sold, fell apart. The family got a lot of money, which was nice to see Hughes, but other than that, the IMG giant is basically not much longer.
You're right, Keith, and it's sad because, you know, Mark was the founder, the father of sports management. I mean, if there's too many agents today, and there's a lot of people that would raise their hands and agree with that one, back in the day, Mark started the whole industry. He began with not a bad starting lineup, by the way. His first three clients were Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and Gary Player. But he's the guy that made a business, an industry, out of representing professional athletes. And, of course, he went on to represent all kinds of other people in various walks of life. It's funny, IMG, everyone thinks of sports, and rightly so, because we were dominant in golf, dominant in tennis, tournaments around the world that we managed and created. But IMG, believe it or not, actually had at one time clients as diverse as Derek Jeter and Margaret Thatcher, as diverse as Serena Williams and classical violinist Itzhak Perlman. So you can see how the tentacle spread. It's an amazing story. And we chronicle a lot of that in the book, Keith, the growth of IMG. We weren't trying to write a history of IMG, but it just seemed appropriate, along with my story, representing, you know, top golfers, to kind of follow along how Mark expanded the company. So I think people will enjoy that.
Did Mark McCormick ever tell you the origin of IMG? Did he ever tell you how it came to be?
He did. He was a young lawyer in Cleveland. and where IMG headquarters remained for all of his life thereafter. And he was a good golfer himself. He qualified for the U.S. Amateur twice and for the U.S. Open once, which is, you know, quite an achievement in and of itself. And in those places, particularly the U.S. Open, he bumped elbows with and got to know a few of the pros in the locker room. And several of them came up to him and said things like, "Mark, look, you're a lawyer. Could you just take a look at this Spalding contract for me? Because I don't have a clue." And the next guy would kind of raise the same thing. And Mark, out of curiosity, would take a look. And it dawned on him pretty quickly, Keith, that all of these agreements, it sounds crazy today when you know, the inmates run the asylum in pro sports. But in those days, I'll give you an example. Arnold Palmer came to Mark. He had a Wilson Sporting Goods contract. Arnold had signed it in good faith. He didn't really or care. He was just happy to have a good golf equipment contract. The deal gave Wilson rights in perpetuity. Okay, we're not talking 5-year deal, 10-year deal. In perpetuity to Arnold Palmer for golf balls, golf clubs, golf bags, golf gloves. And, you know, Mark looked at this and said, "This is nuts." And, of course, immediately became unpopular with a lot of golf equipment companies when he started talking to them on behalf of players. But make a long story short, Arnold Palmer, right at that moment when Mark got to know him, late 50s now we're talking about, Arnold won the Masters in 1958. 1960, he wins the Masters again. Dwight D. Eisenhower, people won't remember this, but he was a golf nut.
Yep.
He played something like 150 rounds at Augusta National during his 8 years in office. And television was starting to develop, Keith, on a national basis. And all of a sudden, televised golf was on the scene. Arnold Palmer, with all of his charisma and popularity, was being seen in living rooms around the country. And the whole business of pro golf kind of exploded. And Mark was right there at the beginning.
So the origin I'm talking about is actually before he came up with that. Bob Toski, who is a dear friend and a regular guest on this show, told the story of how IMG came to be. He and Mark McCormick got to know each other. And Mark went to him and said, this is Toski telling the story, "I'm going to have dinner with my parents. Can you tell them that this idea will work?" And Toski did that, and apparently it worked. I don't know if you knew that or not, but that's according
had
to...
Had not heard that story. I'm Toski and Mark, I know we're very good friends for decades, and it's very possible. Actually, Mark and another guy in Cleveland, Mark's working as a lawyer, 9 to 5, and on the side, Mark developed with this other guy a little business booking golf pros into exhibitions around the country. That sounds crazy now with all the prize money there is, but back in the day, there wasn't much prize money to play for on the tour, and pros were looking for income opportunities off the golf course, and exhibitions were very popular. For example, it might not have been a tour event in Washington, D.C. area at that time. And so Congressional might bring in 4 pros. They'd go to McCormick and say, "Listen, if you can get us Arnold and Jack and 2 other guys, we'll pay XYZ, we'll pay their expenses." The pros came. It was a win-win for everybody. You know, the members of the club got to see. I said Congressional. It's a bad example because they did have major championships in those days. But the members would get to see up close and personal these great stars on the tour. The pros were getting paid what was pretty good money in those days, and they loved the outside income. And, of course, Mark was organizing it and taking a commission. So everybody kind of made out on that. And then it just quickly grew. The ascension of Palmer with his charisma, with his popularity, just all dovetailed, and Mark was, and he's the first to admit, "I was the luckiest guy in the world. You know, I was there at the right time." And lo and behold, Gary Player came along about a year after Arnold and Mark shook hands for Mark to represent Arnold. Gary Player was winning everything around the world, had not yet come to America. And then another year later, this big burly kid from Columbus, Ohio, who was knocking the cover off the ball, Jack Nicklaus. So there's the 3 guys he started with, and off they went.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing story what was created there. And you mentioned the great Arnold Palmer, and always one of Arnie's army buddies growing up. You know, you had to be part of Arnie's army or you were for Jack. And Jack was always the other side. He was the Darth Vader guy that, you know, you didn't like. So even for me later in life when I was a bit at course openings with Jack or different events and stuff, you know, you got to warm up to the guy. So, you know, and he's a great humanitarian and his wife Barbara is right there with him. And so nothing negative ever to say about Jack Nicklaus. Still deemed the greatest golfer ever. But Arnie had this warmth. It didn't matter if I was at an opening with him. I met him for the first time in 2000. I was out for a media day at the U.S. Open in Pebble Beach. And my flight is in the morning, and I'm last one. I said, okay, let me go back to my rental vehicle, grab my putter, and then I'll putt around a little bit, and then maybe I'll go to a late dinner or something like that. So I go to my rental vehicle. I open up the hatch, pull out my putter. There is a black limousine, a town car, really, in front of me, and out steps the king. It was one of those moments that in life that, you know, so many years later, you're like, you just have such great appreciation, not knowing it was going to happen, and it did. And Mr. Palmer, you know, I don't usually do this, but professionally, but, Mr. Palmer, can I get a picture? And the driver's name was Joe, and Joe, you know what to do. So he took the picture and still proudly displayed on my golf wall. So those kind of moments.
And that's a perfect example, Keith. And that's what made Arnold beloved. Unlike a lot of these kids today who don't have the time to sign autographs and just walk right by little kids wanting a photo. Arnold, and that's a perfect example, took the time. He didn't know you. Get a photo taken with you. He cared about people. And one of the major things he did, he made eye contact with people in the gallery. So everybody felt like, you know, I'm his friend. And of course, they'd never met him. But people always say to me, what is it that you're looking for? You're an agent. What's it in a player? Well, Arnold, you know, epitomizes it. And you can't fake it and you can't buy it. But it's person, obviously talent. You've got to be very good at the sport you're playing, and personality. But charisma is just a natural thing. And Arnold wasn't trying to do any of that. That's just the way, you know, he was brought up. He treated people well. He signed. I've seen it. You probably did too. He would sign for up to an hour after a round. Just go right down the line, sign and sign and sign. It's a wonder his hand didn't fall off.
Yeah.
Well, and signing visors, signing programs. I mean, just beloved.
The reason his hand would never fall off is because he came from a blue-collar family, and his father instilled a lot of things with him. And Arnie's hands weren't huge, but they were so muscular. If you shook his hand, or when you did shake his hand, you're like, oh, yeah, don't squeeze too hard, Mr. Palmer, please.
So, totally.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're a young guy. You get your law degree, and you decide, hey, I want to do sports management. Now, first of all, to have something in Cleveland, and I have nothing against Cleveland because now I have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to go to. My good buddy John, a different John, is a huge Brownies fan and been up in Ohio for a long time. So he's pitched me on coming up for a Browns game this coming season. And then now I get to see Hughes Norton, who apparently lives in or works around Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
Correct. That's a little suburb.
Yeah, but Chagrin just kind of went right into that. You live in Chagrin Falls.
I was chagrined at the end of my career with what happened, for sure. But Cleveland was a complete, I mean, you know, that's where Mark started. He never moved. He wasn't here very much, Keith. He flew all around the world. He was gone 25 days a month, at least, flying to all of IMG's, you know, international offices and you know, pitching people on deals and everything that he did. So he didn't have to stay here very long, particularly not in the winter. And it wouldn't have been in anybody's top 10 cities to live in. I was in business school getting my MBA, and I met him just accidentally at a lecture hall, and I listened to this guy, and he was talking about his company. And again, back then, there were no agents. There was no sports management business. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, you know, you can work in this field? That is so cool. Who doesn't love sports?
Right.
So I'll tell you a funny story about Cleveland. Yeah.
Hold that thought for our break as we're with reformed sports agent, closeted broadcaster Hughes Norton, back with more stories on Cleveland and more when we return.
This is Justin Leonard, and you're listening to Tee It Up with Keith Jones.
And I always hate to interrupt guests, but sometimes when you have to go to break, you have to go to the break. But I do commend Hughes Norton for hanging out in Ohio. And it's nice because this show, Tee It Up with Keith Jones, is on 1330 AM WINT and 101.5 FM in Willoughby, Ohio, which used to be WELW for a long time. But that is Willoughby, Cleveland. So, yes, Hughes getting a hometown radio station while he's on. But he, stories about Cleveland, I'm sure they abound. I don't talk to my buddy John up there enough, but I'm sure they're crazy stories.
Well, this room was classic because I didn't know. First, I had to look on a map. I grew up in New England. Keith went to school there, never pretty much got out of that whole area, the six states in New England. And first, I thought Cleveland, you know, Midwest, somebody said to me. So I looked on a map. I started looking out by Omaha. You know, I had no clue where it would be. So luckily, it's in the same time zone. But there was a guy in my section at Harvard, Jim, tell me about Cleveland. And he put his head back and thought for a moment. He said, let me put it to you this way. At 7 o'clock at night, Hughes, you can roll a bowling ball down Euclid Avenue, which is the main drag, and it won't hit anything for 40 blocks. Of course, the inner city in those days, in so many cities, was hollowed out. People worked downtown, got the hell out, went home. So that was my introduction to Cleveland. Oh, thanks, Mark. That's where I'm going to work, huh?
Well, you, though, come up with the you get on board with a guy named Greg Norman. Now, there's a number of steps along the way. So, but you go from Greg Norman to Tiger Woods, both gentlemen we will talk about extensively this hour as we're with Hughes Norton. But how does that come together for you? You're an upcoming sports agent at IMG, and you end up with the number one player in the world, not once, but twice.
Well, you know, like I always tell people, it's always some luck. It's always some hard work. It's always some smarts, you know, some cocktail there. That worked favorably for me. And, you know, I take a lot of pride in the recruiting and the stuff that I did. So maybe it was a little more than luck. But just to set the stage, Greg Norman came to the United States. He'd been quite a global star, you know, Keith, in the 70s growing up in Australia. Then he played in Asia. Then he played in Europe. He was actually best friends in Europe with Seve Ballesteros. And they played and practiced and got better together in the 70s. In the 70s, I had started working for Mark, and I had recruited and been lucky enough to sign three number one players, players who went on to become number one prior to Greg. And in chronological order, they were Tom Watson, Nancy Lopez, and Curtis Strange. And so I was getting a lot of experience. All three of these kids were starting to win tournaments, and I was learning how to make them money off the golf course and give them advice about their career and so forth. So when Greg came along, he had signed with an agent in England. We kind of missed the boat there. Another guy got to him first, but the guy put him into some kind of funky financial schemes. And Greg all of a sudden was facing some big tax liability in Australia. Because when you're in Australia and you're playing golf in Europe and you're also coming to America, the tax laws get very complicated. Luckily, IMG was pretty good at that sort of stuff. So Greg left this guy. I got to know him and recruited him. And obviously, Mark and I had some meetings with him. So in 82, right when Greg came to America, that's when I signed him. He was a client for 10 years. And we did an unbelievable job for this guy, which we're very proud of. And we actually have a chart in the book about the 10 years that Greg was with IMG. Set the stage here. We kind of had a benchmark in our business, Keith, that if you were a client of ours and you're playing the professional golf tour and you're making in those days $100,000, if we could make you close to that amount, that same amount off the golf course, and I give you that sort of benchmark just so you can, you know, appreciate the job we did for Greg. 10 years Greg was with us. He won himself in prize money, U.S. and everywhere else around the world, a total of $10 million. IMG made him $50 million off the golf course. So he was obviously happy with that, and so were we. But like all things, that one came to an end.
Wait. I think Greg Norman thinks he made that money himself. I don't know. He's quite the astute businessman and such. Don't worry. We just started talking about Greg Norman. We got that and Liv coming up after this bottom of the hour break, as we're with renowned, reformed sports agent, closeted broadcaster, Hughes Norton. He's with us this hour and, so much more after this bottom of the hour break. We will be back.
Hi, this is John O'Hurley reminding you you're listening to Tee It Up with Keith Jones. I haven't been this excited since I discovered I couldn't lick my elbow.
the Dalai Lama. I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter.
The Lama.
Long. Into a 10,000-foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
And we're back to start the second half hour of the show, spending it with Hughes Norton. He has been a recluse for the last 25 years, finally decided to get together with George Pepper and write a book. Now, this is only one volume. This was actually only a couple hundred pages for the interview. I said, you know, let me delve into, obviously, Hughes had a huge reputation, so he wasn't unknown to us, and certainly a guy who did a lot for the golf world, but maybe too much on that, because he got fired by two number one guys. He got fired by Tiger Woods, and then he got fired by Mark McCormick. So, I mean, it's a heck of a resume. I have to say that, Hughes. But let's get back to the...
I got to interrupt you, Keith. I tell people all the time when they ask me to talk about my career or my life or talk about the book, I say, I just, at the beginning here, want to say that I've been fired by the two leading golfers of the last 40 years. So feel free to disregard anything I might say today.
All right. Before we get back to Greg Norman, I know you were questioning why you got fired by Tiger Woods. And I have the answer for you, because the same thing happened to Fluff Cowan. And Fluff was a longtime caddy for Tiger Woods. And Hughes knew him very well. But as soon as Fluff started popping out of suitcases, doing hotel commercials, game over. Because when Tiger gets a sniff that you are too much in that limelight and living large or what have you, it's a death blow. I'm telling you, Hughes, I have no doubt. Obviously, Earl, who's no longer with us, was Tiger's best friend and a huge advisor to Tiger. But I think, indeed, that's certainly a big factor in what happened.
Well, I guess I should have done some commercials then, Keith, like Fluff Cowan, because if I was going to get fired, I might have made some money.
Right. That's what it's water under the bridge now. We'll get you an agent, and then we'll move forward on the commercials. But exactly right. But you did one thing. Now, so you've done a lot for the golf world. You've done a lot of things in the golf world. You've gotten names like Hughesy. I think Tiger called you that. Huge. Okay. But the one thing that you did that a lot of people don't know, or maybe you don't want credit for or what have you, is it's your fault for Liv. Okay. There it is. I put it out on the table, because Mark McCormick, and I had John Steinbreeder on the show, and he's a regular contributor. I know, you know him real well. We talked about it, and he took major exception when we started talking about Liv. He's like, that was not Norman's idea, you know, whatever. But it wasn't. Indeed, it was Mark McCormick's idea to do something similar, kind of a parallel tour for players to give them more opportunity. And, of course, Arnold Palmer, the number one guy, didn't like the idea, so it got shelved by Mark McCormick. But lo and behold, in the nice Hughes Norton manner that he has, the friendship that you think you have with people that you're helping to make a lot of money, they get put away, and he mentioned it to a guy named Greg Norman, and now we have Liv. Thanks a lot, Hughes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, guilty as charged, I suppose, because I did tell Greg about Mark's idea, and in the book, really one of the revelations in Rainmaker, the book that has just come out, is that the World Tour, which Greg Norman has spent the last 25 years claiming was his idea, with quotes like, you know, that's how a good businessman thinks. I came up with this. I was thinking outside the box. Well, guess what? In 1967, in his book called Arnie, Mark talks about, he called it the second tour in those days. And Mark, typical, three steps ahead of everybody else, smartest guy I've ever met, had found sponsors, had found network television, had found airlines to fly the players around, had found hotel deals for them to stay in. And he had this concept of 30 players. And the only condition from the networks and the sponsors that were putting up the prize money were that three of them be Jack, Arnold, and Gary. And they said, Mark, you can bring any 25, 27 others, doesn't matter to us. and they were going to play exactly the live schedule. They were going to play less tournaments, so the players would have more time off. The players were going to get salaries, which were unheard of in those days. They were going to get benefits, you know, health, insurance. They were going to play for more prize money, the whole nine yards. So Mark, so excited about this idea in the 60s, went to Arnold with it, and typical Arnold said, Mark, we can't do that. Mark said, why not? Arnold said, because the rest of the guys on tour, you know, we, the superstars, are going to make a lot of money on that 30-man tour, but the rest of the guys, it's going to destroy golf, and I want no part of it. Typical Arnold. So fast forward, now I represent Greg from 82 to 93, and we, you know, flew all over the world together. We spent time together. You talk about a million different things with clients when you work with them as closely as any sports agent does. And I said, you know, Greg, always liked the global aspect of golf all over the world. And he was fascinated by this idea. And the more I talked about it, halfway through, I'm thinking, God, I better shut up. You know, Mark probably never wanted this out. But, of course, he'd written about it in his book. So I thought it was public domain. So anyway, lo and behold, Greg proposes this world tour. You'll remember this, Keith, 1994. He put it was exactly Mark's blueprint from start to finish, all the details included. And Greg got some sponsors and put it to the PGA Tour players. And there was this classic famous meeting in California in 1994 at the Shark Shootout, actually a tournament that I created with Greg that he hosted for years. And Greg pitched the 25, 30 top guys in the room. And at the end of his pitch, Arnold Palmer, still in the picture all these years later, stood up and said, Greg, how many times do you think I've been approached with something like this? He said, it didn't work back then and it won't work now. And then he turned to the rest of the players in the room and he said, look, you guys do whatever you think is right. But for me, I want no part of this. And he turned and walked out of the room. That was the end of the world tour, because all the other players, even at that stage, Arnold was 60 something. They had such respect for him and such admiration. If he put the kibosh on it, boom, wasn't going to happen.
All these years, I've been giving credit to Greg Norman, or almost defending him, because taking his ideas, which apparently weren't his ideas, to the PGA Tour and having them poo-pooed. But I want to, as we're talking to Hughes Norton about his new book, Rainmaker, I want to go right to page 228. I read the whole book. I told Hughes I did, and I don't always have to, but it certainly was good. But right from the book, it says, certainly no individual in the game of golf, no player past or present, has ever been aligned more perfectly with the motives of the Saudis. Power, money, and image burnishing. And as the most polarizing superstar the game has produced, he's the perfect leader of the renegade live circuit. Greg has always been a disruptor, someone who perceived enemies, beginning with a father who disapproved of his becoming a golf pro and thereby became estranged from him, and continuing through a succession of business managers that included me, along with three or four caddies and three wives. His attitude has always been, quote, it's me against the world. I'll get you back. I'll get back at you all. Prove you wrong, unquote. And I had to highlight that, not literally, but just make a note of that, because I just thought that was such a great summation of Greg Norman.
100%. And, you know, he on top of all that, Keith, he, you know, after his playing career came to an end, he kind of was out of the limelight. He always loved the limelight. For that matter, Arnold Palmer did too. But Greg was always about the fame, the adulation, the success, the financial rewards, the Ferraris in the garage, the Gulfstream airplanes that he had. And now he's out of the picture. And he has this great need to be visible and relevant. So lo and behold, the Saudis come along with this, you know, unlimited, bottomless pit of cash. And who is the perfect guy to front that, you know, to front that very unpopular challenge to the PGA Tour? Greg Norman stepped right up to it.
If you think if Greg would have gotten his money anywhere else, we wouldn't quite be, well, you and I would be having this same conversation because he stole Mark McCormick's idea. But, you know, do you think people would think about the LIV Tour differently if it was funded from some other entity?
I do, because, well, there's two parts to that. Greg has never been a popular guy with the other players in the game. Fred Couples had a quote within the last year. It was, and Fred never says boo about anybody. And Fred said, yeah, Greg Norman, he's been hated for 25 years out here. So you had that going on. And then you have the Saudi so-called sports washing, which, you know, Keith, you're familiar with. Anybody listening that's not, people are accusing them of trying to use sport to cover up or kind of make go away some of the brutal things that they do, the way they treat women, the way they treat homosexuals, the way that they, you know, have sort of the famous journalist that was supposedly killed by the Saudis in Washington, D.C., Khashoggi, I think his name was.
Yeah.
But the point is, they, with Greg, perfect marriage, you know, because Greg didn't care. He said, this is my chance to get back on top of the heap. I can be in the news. I can be visible. I can be relevant again. And to his credit, he really believes in this. You know, he thinks that golf has gotten stale, Greg does, that it's every week the same. So let's do team golf. And why? Because the Ryder Cup, which is the team event, any golf fans listening will know, is extremely popular, U.S. against Europe. So Greg's thinking, let's incorporate the team aspect into a weekly basis on the Saudi tour. So he had some ideas that maybe on paper seemed okay. The problem, Keith, as you know, is that the tour has not gained any traction television-wise. It has no ratings. It often isn't even on. But it continues to plug along. Why? Because the people behind it, backing it, have a little private investment fund that's worth $800 billion. And it's so funny because people all the time in the news are saying, well, how long can the Saudis go on doing this? They put $2.5 billion already into this tour over the last 2 years. And I say, well, probably for another 350 years.
So you think it'll just continue? I mean, so let's even get a little deeper in this, because now, I say now, but, you know, not that long ago, the PGA Tour says, we're the 800-pound gorilla. You know, you could live, guys. You're banned from the tour. So they had no idea, did Mr. Monahan and others in Ponte Vedra, that there was a 900-pound gorilla known as the LIV Tour, backed by the Saudis. But then the tour backs up and says, oh, okay, maybe we'll do a little deal together and such. What are your takes on that?
Well, in hindsight, which is always perfect, to be fair, Jay Monahan, the commissioner of the PGA Tour, just blew it. And what do I mean by that? The Saudis at the very beginning, Keith, did not have any dreams of grandeur about having their own tour. They simply wanted to invest in a new sport. What do you mean, new sport? They are already in Formula One racing, the yep. Saudis. They're in Premier League soccer.
Yep.
They're in tennis. They're about to take over part of cricket in India. So golf is not just their only kind of meddling, if you will. They wanted to make an investment in the PGA Tour. And the way the story's been explained to me by some inside sources, they came and said, look, we'd like to put $1 billion, $1.5 billion into golf. We'd like a seat at the table. How do we do that to invest in the PGA Tour? And Monahan and the PGA Tour board told them to pound sand. They were rude and arrogant. Said, get lost. So that kind of started the war, if you will. And now you said, what's going to happen? I mean, there's only one way out of this, Keith, and if the sport is going to survive, and that's settlement. And people always say, what would McCormick do? You know what Mark McCormick would do? If he were involved in this, he'd take Jay Monahan and his advisors, and he'd take Yasir from Saudi Arabia and his team and lock them in a room. And we've seen this in tennis. This happened decades ago, and you'll probably remember this, when the Association of Tennis Pros, the ATP Tour, had a union. They were at war with the various tennis federations around the world, and guess what happened? The only time the top players got together was at the four Grand Slam tournaments, Wimbledon, French Open, Australian Open, and U.S. Open. So guess what? All the other tennis tournaments, which normally were televised and quite popular, they all ended up on ESPN2 or worse. Why? Because the top stars weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see now what's going on, you know, the Saudis have poached six pretty good names, and they can keep doing this forever. I mean, because they John Rahm was totally against going on the LIV tour. Well, $300 million changed his mind, and $300 million, Keith, to them is like $3 million, and I probably even have the ratio wrong. It's probably like 300,000 to the rest of us. So it's just become, it's sad, and it's not being managed well in my estimation. I'm on the outside, easy for me to say, but you've got to settle this. And Rory McIlroy, who I find the most thoughtful, the most appealing, intelligent guy in this whole circus that's going on right now, good for him. He changed his mind. At the very beginning, he hated LIV. He said anybody that went there should never be able to come back and play on the PGA Tour or in Europe. He's changed his mind for the same things that I'm talking about. Rory says, guys, we got to stop this before it ruins professional golf. These guys made a decision. They got huge offers. They did what they felt was right. We got to settle this. I know it's complicated, but we got to get back together to save the game.
Yeah, indeed, because the PGA Tour is suffering right now. I mean, other than, I'm going to say, Scottie Scheffler and Xander and maybe two handfuls of other guys, there's no name value. I mean, and I said for years, this is not disparaging to anybody up and coming on the PGA Tour at all, but I'd rather see the Kings shoot 100, and he'd hate that, I know, than I would watch some of these guys on the PGA Tour. But it's gotten worse, and it's not only getting watered down and stuff. Now you're getting a separation of the classes of the 125. I mean, it's scary what is being proposed, and it's really concerning because professional golf has changed definitely going forward as we know it, and it's about to change more as you mentioned, as we're with Hughes Norton talking about LIV and all the stuff there, but the PGA Tour has to do something quickly indeed.
Here's what's scary. I mean, you've been tracking this, I'm sure, because you have such so many years of knowledge and love of the game. The network ratings, Keith, are down. They're way down for the first quarter of the year. 15-20% television ratings. Sponsors, now, let's say you're, Royal Bank of Canada, and you're sponsoring not only the Canadian Open title sponsor, but also Hilton Head, which they do. Farmers Insurance just dropped sponsorship of the San Diego event. And there have been some other sponsor defections. This is the beginning of trouble, and somebody better wake up here.
Indeed. As we're with Hughes Norton, we'll be back to finish up the show after this break. had this guest on because of his book that he's got out, but we knew he'd be much more layered than just what's going on, has gone on in his life. And, you know, it's interesting talking about the sponsors leaving and such, because I had Tim Finchem on this show a number of years ago and ran into him at Augusta at the Masters, and he's going to be scheduled to come on in the next number of weeks, Hughes. But, you know, I asked him directly. I said, Tim, it's about at the time I had him on, it's about $7 million a sponsor for a golf tournament. I said, you know, when does that end? And unfortunately, what we talked about was not nearly what's going on now.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just escalating. And of course, the tour, in reaction to the LIV prize money, and where the Saudis put up, you know, first prize of $4 million every week, first prize, not total purse. So what does the tour do? They react by bumping up 8 of their events. They call them, I forget what they call them now, but eight events in the tour now went to $20 million purses. Same thing, $4 million first prize. Well, guess who has to come up with that money? The sponsors. And the sponsors are saying, whoa, we're getting less in terms of the player turnout, and you're asking us to pay more money. You know, let's think about this for a second. And then you referred to it a minute ago, Keith, the middle class on the tour, that not journeyman is too rough a term, but there's lots of very, very good players who aren't superstars but are out there supporting the tour, and they make the tour every week. You know, there's 150 guys in every field. You got to have players. And now they're all saying to Monahan, hey, we didn't go to LIV. What's in it for us? You know, how are you going to make our financial lives better? So it's an absolute mess.
Yeah, well, you know, it's beyond a mess, and it's something that hopefully we'll get to talk about in the future with you, Hughes, because hopefully this won't be the last and only time you come on. But it's just it is just crazy. But I think back to the 1997 U.S. Open at Congressional, as I twist this over to a Tiger story real quick, and that's where I first met Earl Woods. Nice guy, nice enough, but I know he was truly, and I'll use the expression not as a pun, but a ferocious tiger when it came to negotiating for his son and being involved in that business. And I just remember him holding court numerous times just that week alone. And obviously, it must have been really trying for you to work deals and get approval, because he was Tiger's advisor, Tiger's best friend, and basically you were the agent, but Earl Woods was Tiger's manager.
Actually, it was much the reverse. Your reaction and your take would have certainly thought that, and a lot of people thought that, but Earl, I think I had known the family long enough. You know, I first knocked on the door there, Keith, and introduced myself and IMG to the family in 1989, when a 12-year-old Tiger Woods came in after school while we were sitting there at 5'4" and 110 pounds, as I remember. And so all those years that he was an amateur, I was kind of advising the family, you know, behind the scenes and building up a relationship. And in the end, Earl totally trusted me. You know, to his credit, he was smart enough to know that he didn't know whether $3 million a year from American Express or the $5 million that I ultimately got Tiger a year from American Express, how would he possibly know with his frame of reference what was the right amount? So on the Nike deal and the Titleist deal, which, you know, were groundbreaking and guaranteed Tiger $60 million before he ever hit a shot as a pro, he totally left it to me. And, you know, I kept him in the loop as we went along, and I would say things to him like, look, Earl, the top two players in the game right now, remember this is 1995, are Greg Norman and Earl and Nick Faldo, and here's what they're each making on golf equipment. How did I know? Because both were clients of IMG. Here's what the top people are making on clothing. It turned out to be Greg with Reebok. I had done that deal. And, you know, we got a multiple of 4 from Nike for Tiger, which in and of itself was insane. I mean, let's face it. Why would anyone pay an unproven prospect so much money? So anyway, those days were fun. Earl was great. He trusted me. Tiger didn't even care. It was like, I just can't wait to get out on the pro tour and kick everybody's butt. And money to him, and we contrast this in the book, and it's fascinating, Keith. Greg, who we're talking about, so flamboyant, so wrapped up in the financial parts of the game, you know, the wealth, the fame, the adulation. Tiger 180 the other way. Didn't care. All he wanted to do was practice, putt, play, go to the gym, come home, play video games, watch ESPN, go to bed, next day, rinse, repeat.
Hughes has been absolutely fantastic having the show. Yeah, and hopefully this won't be the last time. Hughes Norton, my guest on Tita Keith Jones. We are just out of time. It went fast. Get out there and practice your game. Practice. Take your game to the next level. And we will talk to you next week. Take care.